Okay, here we are. So, so that's the last line on the first deck. So I already talked about computer in the loop versus human in the loop, which is sort of one way to think of how the human or the computer fits in the system. This is another distinction that you will often see explicitly, but more often sort of implicitly. So you can see in this human-computer interactive systems, you can see the computer as a tool, and what I've presented so far was mostly presented from that perspective. In fact, the focus of this course is going to be on the computer as a tool. And the idea, sometimes it's called first-person interfaces, and the idea is that the human is in control, and the system is used as a sophisticated tool, but, you know, no different in a sense from a pen or a machine, to augment the capabilities of the user. So in the computer as a tool, we make a clear, well, not only distinction, but the human and the computer really have different characteristics, and we actually try to play out the difference rather than to make them similar. And that's in contrast with the computer as partner, which are sometimes called second-person interfaces, where the goal is to let the computer communicate, and usually the word is communicate rather than interact, with humans using a sort of human ways of communication, in particular speech, and in more generally language. And that's with the idea where you delegate tasks to the computer as opposed to sort of using the computer as a tool to help you with your task. So things like agents are in that category, or you know, this human, virtual humans that you see more and more when you have this animated character that's sort of talking to you. But if you think of a system based on voice recognition, like Siri on iOS or the equivalent on Android, it's also based on this idea that you know, you're having a dialogue with someone who can be a person. So these are second-person interfaces. And then there is a third thing, and I decided to call them third-person interfaces, but it's this notion of computer as medium. Where the computer is a way to sort of mediate communication between human beings. So, you know, in the early days we had email, and then we had things like chat and conferencing, and these days you have social media all over the place, so it's more sort of well-known today, but it's a very different role for the system to sort of be a tool that augments the user, to be a partner where you can share tasks and behave as you would with other humans, and as a sort of medium of communication that is sort of, in a way, transparent, but also enables different things depending on whether it's a one-to-one medium, like typically chat or email, or whether it's a broadcast, like a number of social media things. So I think this is a useful way to look at computer systems, and it doesn't mean that something has to be completely in one category or the other. You may find systems that would have elements of one and elements of the other. But essentially you're going to design your system very differently in each of these categories. And for better or for worse, especially between the first two, these are two different, fairly different communities of people working on this, both in research and also, in fact, in industry. In computer as partner, I should also put probably all the robotic stuff, or a lot of the robotic stuff, where you have these robots, whether they are pets or actually humanoid ones, they try to build on human communication skills. Does this make sense? Okay. So, now I'm
trying to leave this here. And I'm going to switch to the second deck. It's very weird to do this with your interface in the back. There we go.
Okay, so the second part about is about the history of HCI, and it's going to be a short history because we all want to go to lunch. Now, if you want to practice your French, I wrote an article that was first published in a small French conference, but then is available on this website called interstice.info. It's all in French, but it's a nice website managed by INRIA to try to make computer science more accessible to people at large. So I think it's important to know history. I think, you know, we always say, well, computer science is so young and this and that. Well, it is so young, but it's less young by the year. And there are things that were created even before I was born that I think were pretty important for the field. And oftentimes we reinvent things that were created a long time ago. The other reason why it's important to know about history is because even though we're being told that, you know, innovation in computers can go so quickly from an idea to a product, this is bullshit. It's not true. I defy you to find some product where you cannot trace the history less than 20 years. So, two questions. You know when the mouse was invented?
1960s.
Late 60s, 70s. Don't look at your slides. 1963. Okay. First multi-touch tablet. The thing that Apple invented.
In the 90s? 80s? 80s? 90s? 80s? 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 77.
Multi-touch. Tablet, simple tablets, that's, yeah, I mean, even in the 50s they had, well, in fact, we'll see a video with a touch screen. Well, touch. Pen-based thing. So, the thing is, a lot of the things that are presented like they're just been invented, no. And there is a big difference between invention and innovation that we'll get to at the end of this deck. So I'm not going to talk about it now. But it's important to know because the history of things, because I think it's Bruce Sterling or William Gibson who said that. But you know, the future is already there. It's just not evenly distributed. So we've already invented the thing that will change the face of computing 20 years from now. It's just we don't know which one it is. Right. Anyway, so let's start. And usually, a lot of people start the history of HCI with Vannevar Bush's Minix. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes.
Yes. Right?
Yes, but I never understood how it really works.
Well, you never understood how it really worked because it never worked, because it was never built.
Yes.
That's simple. But what was, so that was done in the 40s, which is around the time when computers were born as well. But so Vannevar Bush was an important person who, I believe, he created the DARPA. But he was an advisor to the president. And he had what is seen today as a vision for a system which at the time, as depicted here, was an electromechanical system that would be able to file documents, to retrieve them according to some keys you would punch to do sort of a kind of a search, bring the documents, allow you to annotate them and store them, etc. Now, it was a completely, he had no idea how to build the thing, but he wrote a very, what's called a seminal article called As We May Think, and the title is not even here, which surprises me, but the article itself is on the website, that was a visionary article in that it did anticipate this notion of information going from paper to a medium where you could easily store it, annotate it, find it, I mean, search it, etc., etc. So this is seen as, this is often presented as sort of the birth of the hypertext, because he also had this idea of linking documents together. So this thing was never built, but it did influence a lot of the thinking that went on when computers were starting to be more available. And so then the second sort of interesting point in this very short history is a system called Sketchpad. So Sketchpad was Ivan Sutherland's thesis, PhD thesis at the MIT Lincoln Lab. And the computer that he's using is called the TX2. And it was a computer probably the size of this room, but it was designed as a personal computer. And that there were these big, you know, racks and things, and you can find pictures online. But there was this screen here, which was an oscilloscope that had been tweaked. It was used with a light pen. So you see here the light pen. The light pen is really light pen in that it has a photoreceptor so that it can detect the position by scanning. And then on the side it had a bunch of push buttons, literally push, not like this, but sideways, to select among a set of commands. Now, we are in 1963, as I said, and I'm going to try to show you a video, which is not this one, or this one, or this one, or this one. And this one is black, so that's not a good sign. No, it is Sketchpad. I don't know, there's no sound. Okay, so here, I hope you can see. So he's drawing he's drawing this shape here, and what he's doing here on the left is that he's specifying that all these segments should have square angles, and then the system automatically solve this system of equations, if you wish, to turn the to satisfy the constraints. Then he's going to draw two more lines. Here is another button that said, I want these parallel, so they just adjust. And then is going with another button to turn them into a dash pattern. So you see that it's doing this click here. Now this is done on a computer that probably have less computing power than, I don't know, your watch today or your... Okay, and then what it's going to do, so you see you can zoom in and out continuously, which I still don't know how to do in Photoshop, is turning to a different mode here, and is going to create another object, which is it's called a rivet. So again, the system automatically attaches these points together. Here's another button to do circles, and here's going to say again, square angles along all these things, so the thing will reshape itself. And then he wants, okay, so he's adjusting the height, making it a bigger head. And the system remembers the constraints that it gave, so it can solve again the square angle thing. And we see here a third time. Now, why did he put these two diagonal lines here? Well, I don't think we see it in this in this video. But now he's created this other object. He can put it into his other diagram. He can rotate it again in real time. He can adjust it and show that this rivet is going to go into this place. He can scale it as he's moving it. I don't know how to do that today on my computer. And adjust it. So this was done in 1963. Something you can see, I think, at the end of this video, but maybe it's in another segment, is that in fact, what is done here is an instance of the object he designed before. And so he can go back and change the model, and it will affect all the instances that have been created from that model. And so, I mean, this is something where even today you have a number of manipulations there that are not available in CAD systems, right? So Sketchpad was really created all the sort of basic language for what we call now direct manipulation. It had this notion of geometric shapes that you can sort of create with freehand drawing. It had geometric constraints that few systems have today. Usually you can build things with geometric constraints, but you cannot apply them after the fact. Or if you apply them after the fact, they're applied at your drawing now, but then they're not remembered when you change your drawing. It had continuous zoom, rotate, and even simultaneous dragging an object and rotating it and zooming it. And essentially all the vocabulary of click and drag interfaces. But it was also using this bimanual interaction. So while you were doing things with your mouse, you could punch buttons that affect what the mouse is doing. So, I don't know. I mean, this is something that I find mind-boggling when you... I mean, the thing is, every year I teach this, the students are less and less surprised. So... I don't know what it is, but you guys are blasé, as we say in English. So let's try Doug Engelbart then. So Doug Engelbart is my hero, and I think many people's heroes. He has unfortunately passed away very recently, and unfortunately. He was mostly sort of recognized after his recent death as being the inventor of the mouse. And I think it kind of shadowed what I think is really the important part of his work. So Engelbart is a guy who went to Second World War and came back saying, well, it's really stupid to use our energy killing each other. And what can I do that would be useful to prevent this from happening again? And he realized that the a lot of problems in the world were due to things where a single person couldn't solve it by themselves. Even a group of people couldn't solve it by themselves. Computers, which were starting by the 60s to be, you know, fairly widespread, could not solve the problem by themselves. And so what we needed to do was to really combine the intellectual power of humans with the computational power of computers to address complex systems, the complex problems that had to do with improving the infrastructure or creating new industries for, like, I don't know, air travel or things like this. And it really spent his whole life, and even in recent years he was still active, with this notion, which was the title of his seminal paper, called Augmenting Human Intellect. And his idea was the human intellectual power was sort of greater if you put more people together and if you let them use the right tools. And so he did invent the mouse, but he also created bilingual interaction, and you created video conferencing and hypertext and document sharing and cooperative work. But they did all that not like Sutherland, who was mostly doing this as sort of an engineering feat. And in fact, Sutherland went on to create the company called Evans and Sutherland, which was a big company doing graphics machines. He was the first one to do a virtual reality helmet, display helmet. But what even Sutherland did was mostly engineering feats. I mean, amazing things, but very different from Engelbart, who was driven really by wanting to save the world, in a sense. And so what I want to show you is a little segment from something that is known as the mother of all demos. So in 1968, after several years of working on this system, which was called first NLS, or Online System, and then renamed Augment, Doug Engelbart organized a demonstration in San Francisco in front of 2,000 people at one of the main computer science conferences at the time. Now, nobody had ever done anything remotely like it. And not only was he giving a demo on stage in San Francisco, but a lot of the things was, in fact, happening in Menlo Park, where his lab was situated. And what we're going to see, so in the beginning of the demo, and you can find all of it online, and I've put the links in the website, in the beginning of the demo, it's showing his hypertext system and how you create documents and you can link them, etc., etc. And then the segment I'm going to show is about having group work. So let's see what this is like. If I can switch again, yes. Here's Doug.
So I'm going to establish a collaborative mode between me and another terminal.
In here?
So Bill, will you come in through this intercom?
Hello, Doug.
Hi. I'd like to have him see my text. So on his display, he sees my text. So I'll execute it. And sure enough, it does. But what's that? Running.
So here, it's hard to see because of the quality of but there is his cursor and the Doug's cursor and the Bill's cursor. Well, we don't see it in this particular frame, but they have multiple cursors, so they see the same thing and they see each other's cursor.
Wow. Well, if he's looking at my text, he'd like to have something to say about it. So we put on a marker, a tracking spot that he controls. So he's sitting there in Menlo Park looking at this text, and he can point to it. But we've carefully reserved for me the right to control and operate on this, so my bug is more powerful than yours. But we can have an argument.
Yeah.
That's what they call a bug fight. Now, computer, do the automatic switching that'll bring in a camera picture from the camera mounted on his console, such as the camera mounted on mine is. Hi, Bill. That's great. Now we're connected. Audio, you can see my words, you can point at it, and I can see your face, and we can talk.
So this is Bill English, who's actually probably more the real inventor of the mouse, at least they did it together. And so he is sitting in Menlo Park, which is, what, 30, 40 miles, 50 kilometers, 60 kilometers away. And they're doing video conferencing, live video conferencing, with audio in a document that they're editing together. That was done in 1968. I was not able to do this on my computer. I'm not able to do this on my computer today. I can approach it. I can have Skype running on one side and Google Doc and etc. I still don't have the real cursor in Google Docs. I only see the text cursor, so I cannot do things like gesturing and things like this. So why could it do it in 1968 with the computing power that's sitting in your watch today, and we still don't have it today?
There's a web called Join Conference or something, just log in and people can type together, but it's kind of bizarre if you have more people and everyone trying to type in, you can, I don't know, it's not a very good experience for me, but we do have a sort of website.
But it's happened over the last really couple of years. I mean, I've done a lot of work on video conferencing, one of the things, and shared editing. And even shared editing today, means we all have to share the document in the same format with the same thing. I have to stick my document in Google's cloud, and I'm sorry, but I don't trust particularly Google. I don't trust anybody. I mean, I don't trust Apple much more. But and if you are using a Word and I'm using Pages, we cannot collaborate, right? No, no, I can't. I can't share. I can't share a document, a text document, in real time, unless we're all on the same platform and I allow some third party I don't know to host my documents, right? But the thing that is more important is not so much the fact that it's technically feasible. The thing that is strange to me is that this is such a common situation. I mean, all the time we work on documents jointly. In our lab, we write dozens of articles a year. We never write articles with a single author. And we're still struggling with, you know, some people do LaTeX and SVN or GitHub or God knows what. Others are struggling sending Word files by email with the annotations that make the things unreadable. And of course, if you like one, you cannot use the other. And all the authors have to agree beforehand what they're going to use and all that. So why is it that things we do every day are not supported by the technology? Right? That's the question you should ask yourself, whether you want to go into industry or to go into research. There are basic needs, basic things we want to do that are completely impossible today or practical. I don't want to say possible. There's probably someone somewhere who's done something. But to me, this ability to share things should be built into every computer in the same way as I have email, I have text editing, or I have a calendar. No? Does it make sense? Am I... Okay, so... But the thing is that this happened because really he was driven by a particular vision. And I think what happens today is people are driven by how can I make money by with my little idea and sell it to a bunch of people and then sell it to a bigger fish who's gonna acquire me. And I've seen that, I spent 2 years at Stanford. You have a class like this at Stanford, you have them build an app, a mobile app. Well, they come to the class that Anastasia is teaching for the M1 students or for the M2 students, a class on programming interactive systems. How the students at the end there have they have their app on Google Market, where they call it these days, or on the App Store. And then a few of them will do a startup, and maybe one of them will make some money and will get acquired. But they never really think in terms of, how can I solve a real need? They sort of invent what I call rich people's need. Who needs another social network for people with this particular demographics? And when at the same time, and everybody's moving to mobile and stuff, when there are basic things on the desktop that still don't work. And anyway, that drives me crazy, as you can tell. Let's move on. VisiCalc, invention of the spreadsheet. That's also something quite amazing. It's quite amazing because this is an example. There's a saying, and I don't remember the author, but someone said, a good design is better than you think. A good design is better than you think. You should be writing this down, just saying. It's very profound because, and this is a very good example of this. So the spreadsheet came about because Dan Bricklin was at Harvard, I believe, learning in a business school, and they had to do a lot of adding things by hand. And so he created this little program for the Apple II that ended up being called VisiCalc, where the system would do the adding for him. But instead of doing something very sort of dedicated to this one task, he did something much more general. In fact, he worked with a friend of his, whose name should be in there, especially since it's not in my head anymore. But they built a system where, in fact, you would write formulas in this array, in this table. And so it was more than what they needed to solve the problem. And it's an example where it was better than they thought, because it completely changed even the way to do accounting or budgeting. Until then, you know, you do a budget, you say, well, here's my income, here's how I'm going to spend it. And every time you change a number, you need to add things again. And so it's painful, and so you try to get it done as quickly as possible, even if it's not perfect. Now, with a thing that recomputes automatically, you can do things radically differently, which is you can try what-if scenarios very, very quickly. You can change the numbers and see, oh, what happens here and there. And so even in the domain area for which this was created, this completely changed the way people were doing budgets. But then people are starting to use this for things that have nothing to do with doing budgets. It was released on the Apple II, and so people are starting using it to do all sorts of things, and not just calculations. I mean, there are things like DLSI circuit design that's done in spreadsheets. You have all sorts of uses of spreadsheets where people, it's a good example where the power of innovation of end users has been really amplified by this, because people all keep finding new uses for spreadsheets. So it's very interesting, because it's one of the rare examples where a new category of software was created out of, you know, a seemingly mundane task and turned into something that everybody uses today for a variety of things. You know, the list that you signed at the beginning of the lecture today, I did it in Excel. Why? I mean, there's nothing to compute there. It's just, you know, a table is very convenient. And if I try to do a table in Word, I'm going to spend the day. And here it's really obvious. So spreadsheets really had a massive impact on the development of personal computers. And then we come to the Xerox Star, and that's a fascinating history, because Xerox, and I don't know if I have time to go through this now, but let me try to do it quickly. So Xerox, why is Xerox known for? Yeah. Well,
copying machines,
yes. So Xerox invented xerography, which was a technique used for photocopying. And they had sort of monopoly on this because of their patents in the, 60s and 70s. And then they saw their patents running out, and they figured out, okay, what can we do? Because, you know, other people are going to do copiers, and we need competition, so... And they did something quite amazing. They created the research center called PARC, Palo Alto Research Center. Palo Alto is a city next to San Francisco in the Silicon Valley. And they created a research center that had physicists and people working on materials and all that for improving their photocopying stuff. But they also created the entire lab dedicated to creating new computers. And not only new computers, but they created new programming languages. They created Smalltalk, for example. They created operating systems. They created the Ethernet protocol. If you look at what PARC did in the 70s and 80s, it's a place where everybody wanted to be more than MIT or any other place. And one of these projects, which was started by Alan Kay, who was another hero of mine, ended up with a machine that was actually sold on the market to secretaries, to executive secretaries, for them to help them do their work, which was office work, writing memos, doing tables and charts and things like this. And this is the invention of the window. This is the invention of the desktop as we know it, of document, editing documents on the computer, of doing direct manipulation editing, of icons representing the folders, the documents, the inbox, the printers, etc. And all of today's graphical user interfaces was really invented there. So this is an example of the display of the star, and you can see windows, you can see icons, you can see a document that contains a table, a graph, a diagram, a mathematical formula. I can do things in Star that I don't know how to do today. In my document, I don't have to go to an Excel or something else. I can edit a table, and I can draw a bar graph here that is linked to that table so that if I change a number here, the bar graph adjusts. You know how to do that today?
Well, it is possible.
It is possible, but painful. You're going to have to go into Excel, you can do some embedding, maybe other things still exist. I know myself, I don't know how to do it simply without copying, pasting, and losing the link and stuff like that. Now, the thing that is interesting is that this system was really designed for a particular audience, those executive secretaries. Executive ones because you're not going to spend the $50,000 or whatever it was on every secretary in your company, so you take the ones at the top to start with. But it's because they were targeting this market, and they were targeting this market because they are their market for their big copiers. So these are the world they know. And this is why we have the desktop interface still today. The reason they had icons looking like folders, or like there's a calculator here, or a mail tray, etc., is because these were the objects that these people were having to deal with in their everyday tasks. So, of course, now we use computers for things that have not much to do with this, but we still have kept all the basic organization, and the basic visual language, and the basic interaction. So, now I have... time to lunch. So, we're going to stop here for today. What I will do tomorrow is show you a segment from a video about the star and talk a little bit more about the star. And then we'll finish this historical part of things. And what I want to show is that, in fact, contrary to popular belief, I think the evolution of interactive systems, in a sense, has gone forward, but in many senses also gone backwards. In that already from the Engelbart's notion of supporting group work to the Xerox Star, we've lost the group. The Xerox Star, in fact, was a network machine, and what you'll see in the video is the first thing you do is you grab resources on the network to bring them to your machine. But there was no support for group work in the same way we saw it with Engelbart. When we go to the Macintosh, it's even worse. Then we go to the web and we'll lose something else. So every time we gain something, we've lost a number of other things. And so that's why I want to do this historical perspective, is to tell you, there's no shame in going back in time and stealing good ideas that sort of got lost along the way and try to reinterpret them today. Okay? Any question? No? Well,
same class.
Right? Same class. No. B109, because that's where you normally have a TA and didn't try to change the room. So it's I think it's B109 and it's at 9. And I'll see you then.
Which room should I go to? Room 6.
In the building.